By the way, I'm Rob Maines. I'm a writer for Baseball Prospectus. I can tell you that much at first. And I think that the text of this presentation, if I'm able to get the presentation up here, will be at our website Monday and Thursday of next week if you want to read the full text, if you fall asleep during this or if you're not listening. And it probably won't be behind our paywall. I also, if I can just put in a brief pitch, I'm the manager of BP Español, which is our daily Spanish language translation of articles on the site. And if anyone here is bilingual and is reading that, please grab me at some point. I'm going to be here for the whole conference. I'd love to hear your feedback. Almost as much as I would love to know how I'm supposed to get my presentation up here. Is there? Ah, there he is. Sorry, my presentation that I sent in a while ago didn't get to the right hands, but it's about to. The topic today is a revised look at clutch hitting. And I told you about who I am. I'm Rob Maines. To be able to give this presentation immediately after Pete got his award is really an honor. This is something that he and I worked on together, and working with Pete was a real thrill, and I will tell you that throughout this presentation, all the statistical heavy lifting was 100% Pete's. I'm just the eye candy that he got to do the presentation for him. Okay, so the idea for this presentation actually dates back to last year's conference. One of the presentations was a panel discussion where the topic of clutch hitting came up, which immediately, when it was open for Q&A, started looking around the room for Dick Kramer, who I've gotten to know through this conference. Dick, as you may know, wrote kind of the seminal piece of research in the Sabre Baseball Research Journal in 1974 on clutch hitting. And in his presentation, his conclusion was that clutch hitting basically doesn't exist as a skill that we can measure. Now, this was in 1974. He was using data that Pete had developed for 1970 and 71, so a little data constrained at the time. But subsequent attempts by various sabermetric researchers to find clutch hitting mostly have come up dry as well. And that's sort of where the industry's thought was until 2003, I think it was, 2004, when Bill James wrote a piece, also in the Sabre Research Journal, entitled Underestimating the Fog, where he described how, you may get to see the cute quotes that I excluded. He said that maybe clutch hitting, in fact, does exist as a skill, and the fact that we haven't found it is suggestive that there is a problem with our methods that aren't up to the task of finding it, rather than a problem with whether it exists at all. And so that ignited a new set of research of controversy in sabermetric circles as to whether it exists. So let's talk about where we stand right now in sabermetric circles about clutch hitting. To say that sabermetricians say that clutch hitting doesn't exist is not just a simplification. It's kind of verifiably false. If you go to Sean's website, you can look for any year, divide players into how they do in high leverage situations versus other leverage situations, and there we go. And in every year, there's some players who perform better than others. And I want to get this loaded because I got a really good slide for this. Okay. And thank you. All right. So then, and that's Dick's quote from his research, and that is, oh, it's 1977. I got my years off. All right. So what I did was I looked at hitters since 1988 with a leverage index in all their plate appearances with a minimum of 500, in which there was a leverage index of greater than 1.5. And those of you, if you don't know leverage index, statistic invented by Tom Tango to measure the pressure in a situation. 1 is average, so anything above 1 is a higher leverage situation. Below 1 is a lower leverage situation. 1.5 is what John Foreman uses, a baseball reference, I think is a good measure of pressure situations for hitters. So who are the best 5 hitters? Well, those 5 guys are number 1, number 6, number 3, number 2, and number 12, respectively, in total OPS since 1988. So what sabermetricians would say is, yeah, there are guys who do better in pressure situations, but there are guys who do better in all situations. It's not a distinct skill. I'm going to be using that word distinct a lot. The second hesitation that we tend to have is that clutch hitting hasn't proven to be a repeatable skill. A repeatable skill is something like speed or hitting for power or hitting for average, something that a player is going to exist year after year. You don't expect a skill like that to be something that fluctuates from year to year. Example I'll give you, 2013 Cardinals, you may remember, were an amazing clutch hitting team. They batted 330 with runners in scoring position, easily the best performance with runners in scoring position since World War II. Alan Craig that year was an absolute beast with runners in scoring position. It certainly was not a repeatable skill for Alan Craig, because the next year his OPS with runners in scoring position was about half of what it had been. And then I'm going to use this example a lot because obviously David Ortiz is the current model for clutch hitting. This is his batting average with leverage index in excess of 2. That's very high leverage situations. Now, granted, there's some small sample sizes here, but you can see is over the last 6 years of his career, he absolutely seesawed between years in which he was excellent and which years in which he was notably not excellent. So impugn sort of the repeatability of this as a skill. So in looking at this, what Pete and I tried to do is kind of define clutch hitting for purpose of our study. We didn't want to just say it's guys who hit well in the clutch, because as I showed in the previous slide, good hitters tend to do well. So what we looked for is players who meet all sorts of cliches that you hear, you know, bearing down, rising the cage, and whatever. Basically what we're looking for is players who do better in high leverage situations than in other situations. So we ran a simulation, and when I'm saying we here, this is totally an editorial we. This is Pete's hard work. And what we did was created 18 equal players over the course of an entire season, and we assigned each player the typical distribution of hits, errors, walks, strikeouts, etc. And for each player, what Pete did, I will use the proper pronoun here, is calculated the runs that they created in two separate ways. First of all, we looked at the win probability for each plate appearance that the player had, both before and after their plate appearance, to develop a situation-dependent hitting number over the course of a season. This is similar to WPA among advanced stats, just looking at, in a high-leverage situation, the win probability after the at-bat is going to move more potentially than it will in a low-leverage situation. Then the other way we looked at runs created was just basic linear weights, similar to runs created or OPS or anything like that, where all we did was looked over the scope of a player's entire season, how they performed, without looking at how they were doing in individual plate appearances and whether there were runners on base and what inning and what score, et cetera. So then we just calculated a difference expressed in runs, ran 1,000 simulations, and came up with a standard deviation of about 10. Now, in Q&A, if you have questions about this, let me try to head them off two ways. First of all, Pete ran a second simulation in which the 18 players were not identical, where they had a typical variation in skills, and created a batting order that was representative of that, and the results were mostly the same. The second thing is the only reason we ran this simulation was to get the standard deviation. We used the win probability and the linear weights way method of looking at the runs that players produced, but we only wanted to get our standard deviation. And the reason that we needed that was we needed standard deviation in order to calculate Z-scores, which is a statistical measure, for those who aren't aware, of how much result differs from the mean. And what Pete did is we had nearly 9,000 players, which is every player from 1946 to 2017, with over 500 plate appearances in a season, and we calculated a Z-score expressed as the difference between their situation-dependent runs that they created, you know, kind of the clutch runs, versus their situation-independent runs, sort of the basic runs created runs, to determine whether they were good. If their Z-score was positive, they were better in the clutch than in other situations. If it's negative, it was the opposite. Give you an example of this. Robin Ventura in 98 was a little bit above average. True average, TAV, there is a stat that we use at Baseball Prospectus. It's kind of an all-in measure of offensive quality scaled to 260. 98 was a high run environment year, so his 785 OPS was a little bit above average. However, Ventura that year was outstanding in high leverage plate appearances, less so in everything else. And this would be an appropriate time for me to just add, there's not an exact mapping between high leverage versus non-high leverage and the runs that we looked at simply because high leverage versus other high leverage, we're just bucketing. We're saying everything above 1.5 is high leverage, everything below 1.5 is not. While the way that we looked at situation-dependent runs, we looked at every single plate appearance and considered the leverage. So there's not going to be an exact mapping here. And what we found was, in 1998, Robin Ventura had a lot of situation-dependent runs. He was excellent when he was in plate appearances where his teams really needed him to produce. He wasn't all that special in his overall performance, and that resulted in a Z-score of 1.5, which is actually pretty good. Okay, before I get into the full results, I just want to show you one boring statistical chart. This is a graph I did of the Z-scores for the 9,000 players that we looked at. This should be a normal distribution, and it pretty much is. Full disclosure, this is ever so slightly skewed to the right. The mean should be 0. Our mean was 0.08. Median was 0.06. We had more results, not a ton more, but more results above the level of 1 than we would have expected. I wouldn't read a lot into this for two reasons. First of all, there are some seasons, and last year was one of them, where batters actually hit better in high leverage situations than in other situations. The second is we probably have a little bit of bias here just because of the selection that we did of players. Players with over 500 plate appearances are going to be, theoretically at least, better hitters than those who don't reach that threshold. So I want to talk a little bit about the results that we saw. And the first thing I wanted to look at is whether clutch hitting exists as a distinct skill, something we can really look at and say, yeah, players possess this. One of the ways that we would find that is if there are players who year after year rise to the top, who are among the league leaders. And so what we looked at is players who had a Z-score that put them in the top 5%, that's a Z-score of 1.65 or greater, and looked at the number of seasons they did it. And what we found is that there were 14 players who had at least 4 seasons with a high Z-score. That is, there are 14 players who, in 4 seasons, were consistently really outstanding performers in the clutch. And I'm going to just go through the names one at a time. I won't give you comments on all of them. The first one, okay, we'll buy that. He was a pretty good hitter. Okay, then it starts getting a little weird here. This is the point where I started to say, wait, something may be wrong. Steve Garvey, you know, has always been a controversial guy, but he shows up as being pretty good. Okay, we got senior. We don't have junior. All right, he was good, right? Tony Gwynn, give me that one. Slaughter, remember he had that great, well, that was a base running thing, but 46 series, remember that. Okay, Tony Womack did have that really key hit in the 0-1 series off Rivera, so at least give him that. Now, one of the things that Bill James said is that when you're evaluating a statistic, typically what you're looking for is something that confirms mostly what you already knew, but also provides some new information. I don't know whether this works, because there is a lot of information here that I certainly would not have expected. And there's a lot of players whom we would all consider to be good hitters who aren't on this list. Now, this is 13 guys. I said there were 14. Nobody was in the top 5% for 5 seasons or more. And one player, only one, the post-war period, was in the top 5% for this measure of clutch hitting, who clearly hit a lot better in pressure situations than in other situations. He did in 6 seasons, just one guy. Any guesses? I won't keep you in suspense. This won't surprise you at all. When you think clutch, tell me, you think Bert Campanaris, right? Really, he's the only guy that was in our top 5% for 6 seasons. Again, I think this kind of calls this into question. The bottom 5%, this was even more fun, so I made kind of a long list here. This is 3 seasons in the bottom 5%. So at least 3 years, these guys were way worse in pressure situations, okay? Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, good hitter. Okay, I'll buy that. Good hitter, Hall of Famer, good hitter, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, don't argue with me about either. Hall of Famer, good hitter, no comment. Good hitter. All right. These are not the guys that one would expect to see among the list of poor clutch performers. Let's look at four seasons in the bottom 5%. These are guys who four different seasons were way worse in clutch situations than in other situations. Okay, Jay Bell, I'll buy. Hall of Famer. Possible Hall of Famer, near Hall of Famer, could be a Hall of Famer, good hitter, Hall of Famer. Okay, I'm going to move to the next slide. All right, again, these are not guys that you think of as being bad hitters. Now, it could be that all of our perceptions are wrong, or it could be that what we're measuring really isn't the skill. Five seasons in the bottom 5%. All right, good hitter, another Hall of Famer. And then there, just as there was only one hitter who was in the top 5% 6 years, there's only one hitter who was in the bottom 5% 6 years. The only hitter since World War II who, in six separate seasons, was far worse in clutch plate appearances than in others. Okay, and this is a guy. You remember, like in the second slide, he's one of the best guys in high leverage situations. And those of you who are Red Sox fans will probably remember that in some of his bad years, like in this photo, he actually went to the plate in high leverage situations just levitating his bat. He didn't even try to swing it. Okay, so this got me to think, well, maybe this isn't the right threshold. We shouldn't be looking at top 5%, because maybe that's an unfairly high bar. So what I did, and I'll be honest with you, this took about 5 minutes, to look for players who are in the top 5% of some metric consistently, whether that is something that happens a lot. And it turns out, yeah, these are all-time greats, but there are players since World War II who have been in the top 5% of a certain metric consistently. Not only did our list not have anybody in the top 5% more than six times, but also those players, the identities of them, like I say, really calls this into question. Now, I was also able to use this 5% threshold to look at the issue of replicability. Okay, of these guys, you would never expect in a full season in which he's healthy, Randy Johnson to strike out 4.5 batters per nine, Rod Carew to hit 220, Ted Williams to walk 35 times, or Harmon Kilburn to have 5 home runs. You wouldn't expect them to be great and also be terrible. And yet, there were 120 cases, and don't worry, I don't have a slide with all of them, of players who were in the top 5% and the bottom 5% over the course of their career at least once. That means that they were the Rod Carew 367 and the Rod Carew 220. And in fact, we found 12 players who twice were in the top 5%, at least twice, and at least twice were also in the bottom 5%. Remember, one of the things that you want to see in a statistic is replicability. If you've got guys who are great, not just good, but great some years, and terrible in other years, that really calls into question whether what you're measuring is a skill. Okay, and those players are Garrett Anderson, who RBI guy, okay, I get that. All right, near Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer. Yeah, that, I'll let you fill in the blank on that. Sheffield is still on the ballot. Tejeda was very good. Bobby Thompson did have arguably the most clutch hit ever. I don't know about his whole career. Larry Walker, and then another Hall of Famer. And this isn't just once. This is more than once for each being in the best and being in the worst. And I'm going to use the example again of David Ortiz. There's a typo that I did here. The second Z-score should be 1.81. David Ortiz, by our measures, was one of the best clutch hitters, top 5% type clutch hitter in 05 and 06. And then the very next year, he became terrible. And then later in his career, he was terrible another couple times. And before you think that this is an aging thing, Ortiz was kind of unique in that this happened to him. He was good at the beginning of his career, bad at the end of his career. All the other guys, other than I think Pete Rose on that list of 12, their years when they were really good and really bad were interspersed. There was no pattern. And in fact, speaking of no pattern, if you look at David Ortiz's Z-scores over the course of his career, if you can find a pattern here, you're much better at this than I am. I mean, he seesawed from being excellent in clutch situations to being terrible in clutch situations, with a lot of years in between. Again, what this suggests to me is that the lack of replicability, the lack of consistency, suggests that what we're measuring And I think that this is the right way to measure this. Look at a player's performance in clutch situations versus his performance in non-clutch situations, that it's not really a skill. So the conclusions here, first of all, again, in every single year, there are players who do better in clutch situations than in others. That's inarguable. Interestingly, in 2017, the best and the worst were both rookies. Dansby Swanson obviously did not have a rookie of the year caliber season, but if you look him up, he was 853 in high leverage plate appearances as OPS and 582 in the other ones. Aaron Judge on the other extreme. Travis Sawchuk at Fangraphs wrote a piece towards the end of the season that the Yankee fans just loved that said, I think the title was, Aaron Judge is the least clutch player of all time. He was terrible in the clutch. So those are two examples. In a given season, yes, no question, some guys do better than in clutch situations than others. But the results that we got, both for players who are way in the elite clutch category and way in the terrible clutch category, the players that we got are really at odds with our perception. Not only that there weren't anybody who was consistently 8-10 years up there, but the identity of those players, I think, really calls the validity of the measure into question. And then finally, the lack of consistency really impugns replicability. A skill, like I said, like base running, like, you know, not issuing a lot of walks, like having a good throwing arm, those things don't seesaw from year to year. This did. And then not that what Bill James said is wrong, but I think that what Pete came up with is a really large, robust data set on which we did a pretty advanced analysis, and we still didn't find evidence of clutch hitting. Not saying that it doesn't exist, but we certainly didn't find it. So before I go to questions, just want to thank Pete again. This wouldn't have been possible without Pete. Not only this presentation, but also all of us being here. The Lifetime Achievement Award is because Pete was instrumental in creating all the things that brought us here today. And then also, I'd like to thank this conference. Yeah. I'd like to thank this conference because I've been coming here 5 years and all these relationships. I've gotten to know Dick Kramer, got to know Pete, have all been through this conference. This is a great opportunity for everyone here to network. If this is your first conference, I hope you keep coming back. Great conference. So with that, I will take any questions.
Based on what you said at the beginning with our, I guess, the conventional wisdom of good clutch hitters are good hitters in general, which is essentially what you just showed. I have to wonder, and this is devil's advocate, it doesn't mean I believe in clutch hitters, if you actually filtered out the good hitters in general, somehow came up with a parameter there, and then made your threshold lower, could you find people who were effectively underperformers in general? But do they show up at all? Because what it looks like you showed was that a lot of them are not there, and that, you know, maybe clutch hitters, the people who we remember, human beings remember spectacular events. That's just how our brains work. But if clutch hitters happen to exist, they may not necessarily be the people who we remember, but the stat is possible to exist, provided you filter out the extremely good players to begin with. You see where I'm going?
That's a completely valid point. That if you're, you know, if you're Barry Bonds, if you're Manny Ramirez, you've set the bar really high for outperformance if you're already slugging about 1,000 overall anyway. I didn't do that. That would be worthwhile. But the two things I would say is, one, I'm pretty sure I did this. I can't remember. That over the course of his career, Ramirez was about neutral. You know, wasn't a lot better, wasn't a lot worse. What I thought was interesting, though, is that he whipsawed a lot, you know, going high or low, and you saw that Ortiz did as well. But, yeah, that actually, I might
specifically,
I might
I'm thinking
that.
Of lowering your threshold below 5%, because I have a feeling that it may actually be that you've created something that is so small that you're only going to get spectacular hitters, but that the whipsaw makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
Again, I'm devil's advocate.
Yeah, I understood, but yeah, that look, I got to write 2 articles a week for Baseball Prospectus. I'm always loving hearing story ideas. So that's, yeah, that is worth looking into.
I look forward to seeing the article.
All right. Thanks, Meredith.
This has to do with the overall Z-score being higher than 1. Don't the numbers show that Major League Baseball players hit 20 points higher on average with runners on base? And wouldn't that possibly have something to do with the Z-score being higher than 1?
It's, okay, 2 answers to that. It's not that, because I've actually done separately some research into runners and scoring position. It's higher. It's not that much higher. It is higher. I mean, because you think about it, the Baltimore Orioles pitching staff had a lot more plate appearances with batters or with runners on base than the Dodgers did or the Astros. Because you do get that. The difference, though, leverage is not as big a difference. Like I said, last year, batters did better in high leverage situations than in other situations. So yeah, you do better with runners in scoring position, but a lot of times you've got those runners in scoring or even on base in low leverage situations because the pitcher's getting killed.
Fascinating study. As a Red Sox fan, when you had David Ortiz in the bottom, I was a little surprised, I have to admit. But what my question is, what I noticed about Ortiz in particular is that his 2 good seasons were 05 and 06,
right,
which were right after the 04 World Series, the whole postseason, hence the legend, because he backed up the postseason with 2 great seasons.
Yeah.
My question is, other than maybe Bert Campaneris, are there other players who we think of as clutch because they had a couple of good ones early in their careers and seeped into our consciousness that way that you can think of?
That's a good question. Anybody have, okay, I'm not immediately coming. Anyone can think of somebody? John? Oh, Reggie. Great. Yes. Reggie didn't show up on any of these lists here, but that he'd be worth looking at. Okay. Alex Rodriguez did have 1 really good postseason. Yeah. Daniel Murphy recently. Yeah. Yeah. Though Beltran did have a lot of seasons after his good one. But again, those are guys that we didn't see on this list.
To me, it seemed like most of those guys, like when you think of high leverage, you think of, I think the middle of the order comes up more in those situations. Probably I'm sure someone in this room would know. But it seemed like a lot of the guys on that list were more middle of the order hitters. And I think they get more opportunities to have success and also fail. So is that, I mean, maybe you think of the clutch guy being like the number 9. Maybe there's good players, so it's like that's why it's hard to tell, right, which part of the order.
I agree, except we would still catch them because what Pete did is anybody who got 500 plate appearance. So let's, pick a guy. Danny Hecheverria. Anytime he was not batting 8th or 9th, it's because somebody screwed up the lineup card. But he did have 500 plate appearances, and even if just a few of them were high leverage, he would still be in our numbers. I'm just thinking, but you're right. It would be a much smaller sample, which would lead to greater variability. So, yeah, that's probably true.
One thought I've always had when it comes to clutch hitting is that we're putting our perception of what a high-pressure situation is onto the player. The players are professionals. This is their job. It always seemed to me that, a guy at the end of the bench in spring training probably feels more pressure than David Ortiz does in the 8th inning of a tie game, just because that guy's playing for a major league job. So I was wondering, has there been any qualitative analysis, qualitative study of how players perceive pressure in these situations, what they see as actually being high-pressure situations when they're at the plate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the quotes that I forgot to mention, it's one of my favorite of many that Rob Nyer gave us, is because he was doing an article once on clutch hitting, and I'm paraphrasing. I don't know if he's still in the room, but if so, I apologize for paraphrasing it. But he basically said, major league hitters got there because they can handle any situation. There's no question that Rob Nyer in Little League was terrible in pressure situations. And I think that's part of it, that once you reach that. I had a coffee last week with the local college coach, and he talked about how some of his players, I mean, he had some guys that kind of freak out when there's fans in the stands, and that's kind of a tough thing to get past, and various, you know, various things that they do. But that's a good question. The answer is no, I haven't talked to players about it, but that's a good observation, Sean. Yep.
Excellent study. When you think of clutch hitting situations, you also think of game on the line situations. And so it's typically later in the game where it's an obvious game on the line,
right,
high leverage situation. So in your study, there were some players from, it's all modern era, but it was pre-bullpen, you know, five-inning starting pitchers and then bullpen. And that really cuts into clutch hitting because there's specialists coming in. You know, Randy Myers facing Barry Bonds. I mean, you know it's happening. And the other thing I noticed, and I don't know if you can get at this statistically, are hitters that are very disciplined, like the Barry Bonds, the Ted Williams. They don't go out of their game. They don't go out of the strike zone ever. But a clutch player will. So is there some way of looking at, you know, pitches hit that were quality of pitch, that type of thing?
Yeah, let me answer the second one, then the first one. The probably there's a way of looking for pitches. We didn't use pitch data, so, and that obviously doesn't go back as far. And then as far as the current guys facing tougher bullpens, the last slide of my presentation is actually the last slide of my presentation last year. I forgot to change it. But last year I talked about modern bullpens, and what I found is that despite, you know, first the closer and then the one-inning guys coming in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings, the number of late-inning comebacks really hasn't changed that much. So maybe, you know, it's tougher now, but the hitters are better too. So I don't know. I view sort of the advent of the modern bullpen as kind of keeping the balance between them rather than weighing it all the way over on the side of the hitters. One more question.
Yeah, Rob, Wayne Griner with QOP Baseball. A couple of years ago, we introduced our QOP metric, and we've been calculating pitch quality since then. So we've got over 7 million pitches since, right, 2008 where we've calculated the quality. We have done some reports, and we have found that in high-leverage situations, there is a number of pitchers where their pitch quality has definitely gone down in those situations.
That's at the major league level?
Yeah,
at
the major
league
level.
That's really
interesting. Have you looked at, with clutch hitting, you know, have you tried to determine, are these clutch hitters hitting a good quality pitch, or are they hitting mistakes by the pitchers, which obviously, you know, would be quite telling if you could determine that?
Yeah, again, we were just looking at plate appearance data, not pitch data.
So this is something we could work on,
yeah,
maybe together,
yeah,
and just look at the quality of pitch they're facing in these situations,
right,
and then what is the outcome. So.
Right. Okay, thank you for putting up with the slides.
Thank you.